Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Good afternoon and welcome to Unbelievable with me, Justin Briley. I'm your host for the show that brings Christians and non-Christians together for dialogue and debate, and a really great show for you today. Two guests who are joining me to talk about religious disagreement, and they've written a very good book together as well. I'll be introducing them in a moment's time. If you're not familiar with the show and you'd like to become a bit more familiar with it, why not go on to the website of the programme, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Loads of past shows. You can access the podcast, you can find articles, videos, and of course, we're going to be putting up details soon, before the end of January, of the forthcoming Unbelievable the Conference. Yes, we're back again for another year, a bit earlier in the year this time, Saturday the 13th of May, and I'm really excited to be able to tell you next week the theme of the conference. Going to be detailing the theme, some of the major guests we've got speaking at this year's conference, but do put it in your diary if you want, know that you're going to want to be there. Whatever the theme, whatever the guests are, it's Saturday the 13th of May, back at the venue for last year, the Brewery in central London. Looking forward to meeting lots of unbelievable listeners again. It'll be the first chance as well to get your hands on a copy of my book that I've been working on as well. Why, after 10 years of talking with atheists, I'm still a Christian. More details on that to come on next week's programme. For the moment, time to get into today's discussion. Hope you enjoy what's coming up.
You're unbelievable.
Well, today we're talking with the atheist and the Christian who walked into a bar. That's the name, or sort of the name, of a new book by Randall Rouser and Justin Schieber. Randall Rouser is a Christian theologian and philosopher. Justin Schieber is an atheist philosopher. And they've just written a new book together called An Atheist and a Christian Walk into a Bar, talking about God, the universe, and everything. It's published by Prometheus. It's almost like a book version of an edition of this show, actually. Very much a conversational dialogue in which they discuss their reasons for being a Christian and an atheist, respectively. Well, today on the show, they're going to be having a real-life conversation about the conversation in the book. Specifically, a section of the book discussing religious disagreement. If there is a God, shouldn't we expect to find people across the world having broadly similar ideas about God? And if they don't, is that evidence against God? Well, Justin says it is, and Randall says it isn't. So I'm looking forward to today's discussion and just getting how this book came about. It's a really fun read, actually. I've really enjoyed dipping into it over the last week or so. So welcome along to the programme, Justin and Randall.
Well, thanks for having me, Justin. Good to be back.
Yeah, it's good to be here.
It's great to have you both. Randall, I think you're just north of the border. You're a Canadian, aren't you? Is that correct?
Yes, I am. I'm about 5 hours north of Montana for my American friends.
Okay.
By driving.
I don't know, does that kind of give you a different perspective on things to someone like Justin?
Well, I think Canada has often been said as kind of somewhere in the North Atlantic culturally between Europe and the United States. But I think Justin and I, on politics, we're kind of similar. We're both kind of similar in our views of Donald Trump. So,
okay.
So we can start with some common agreements.
Okay, well, I won't get into those opinions.
We'll steer clear of that one.
Justin, it's great to have you back on the show, because although Randall has popped up once or twice a year over the years, it's been ages since we had you on the program. The last time, I believe, was when you were engaging in a dialogue about violent parts of the Bible and so on. You've kind of been interested in atheism and philosophy, specifically around the issues of religious belief, for a long time. Do you want to just start us off by telling us how you got into this area, Justin?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not really sure that it's an easy path to those questions. I think really what it comes down to is the fact that there was a point in my life where I was a believer of Christianity, and then I found myself not believing, but the interest in the questions never went away. So I've only really just dove deeper and deeper into those issues. And so I'm getting more into, I mean, I'm just really interested in the questions. And so I try to read the best people that have anything to say on it. So I'm really into academic philosophy of religion. And so it's always nice to meet someone like Randall who's similarly interested in those questions and can discuss it on a particular level.
Mm. You were a regular contributor to the Reasonable Doubt podcast, which was a few people getting together regularly to talk about issues of faith and belief from an atheistic perspective. Unfortunately, it's not going anymore, is it?
No, we've disbanded, I think, for about a year now, which is unfortunate, but, you know, that's what happens. We have four hosts that have adult lives, and it's hard to get them in the same room, you know, once every couple of weeks. So that was becoming increasingly challenging.
Sure. Well, I enjoyed listening to it on occasion, and I know that you're continuing to engage in other ways, obviously, online. You run the Real Atheology website and YouTube channel. So that's one place to find out more about Justin. And of course, Randall, you can be found at randallrouser.com. You're prolific in terms of the number of books you seem to be able to produce, Randall. I've struggled to get one out in the last 10 years. You seem to produce about two a year. But tell me just for those who aren't familiar with you, Randall, a little of your background and how you first came across Justin.
I was raised within the church, broadly evangelical. I'm currently Baptist. I've been teaching at a Baptist seminary in theology and church history for about 15 years now. Justin, we brought him out a couple years ago to Edmonton, and we had a debate at the University of Alberta. And it was a very productive debate and exchange, both in the debate hall and then afterwards, a group of us going out to a pub and just having a long conversation. And the next night, we had a dialogue at my seminary where we talked about faith and belief in front of a crowd. And that also was very productive. And that got us thinking that, you know, it would be great to take this to the next level and have a book where we go into depth on these issues. And so that was the genesis of the book.
It's not the first time you've attempted to write a book with an atheist. I remember having you on the show with John Loftus a few years ago. But I must admit, this book feels kind of different to that book. Would you agree?
Yeah, I would agree.
Yeah, in that I'm completely unqualified, according to him.
Loftus is known for sharing his opinions with candor, and that is true. Certainly one important difference between John Loftus and Justin Schieber is that Justin Schieber respects the intellectual integrity of his interlocutor. So he believes that theism is a rationally serious position worth engaging. And John Loftus is quite candid about not believing that. And so that does tend to make the conversation to be at least strained, if not somewhat abortive in some degree. And so I thought it was important for this book to find somebody to debate and dialogue with who takes theism and Christianity seriously as an intellectually respectable position.
Yeah, well, I appreciate it. I really appreciate the tone in the book. It feels, you know, when you're reading it, like you guys are friends, you're having a bit of a laugh as you go along. But also, you're not in any way ducking the serious differences that you have. Justin, did it actually get written in a bar, or is that just a fun title for it?
It did not get written in a bar. If it were correctly titled, it would be called A Christian and an Atheist Login to Google Docs. But that was a title that was pretty frowned upon by the publisher.
I mean, it kind of has, you know, you've managed to recreate the feel of it being a conversation, a genuine dialogue, the back and forth and so on. But obviously, you have to have an editing process to make sure that you put it all in a way that
right.
that fits into a reasonably sized chapter and so on. So was it kind of a big conversation which you kind of both edited and worked on until you were happy that it represented the kind of dialogue you do have?
Yeah, I think it boiled down to we were I mean, the raw content was just us going back and forth a few times a day, interacting paragraph by paragraph. And then, you know, we would, I mean, largely the editing consisted of structuring particular parts of the conversation so that it made sense in a broad theme, so that the chapters were digestible in a coherent way and all that. So, and you know, going in and making sure our jokes were sufficiently terrible was also an important step.
You seem to share a somewhat similar sense of humor in many ways, but I really appreciate the work that's gone into that, because it does make it very accessible. And sometimes these ideas can be parsed out in ways that go over people's heads. But I think doing it in that dialogue way, maybe in the kind of way we model a little bit on this show, helps people to kind of get carried along and understand what the issues are. So coming back to you, Randall, what for you is the advantage of doing a book like this in this very much dialogical? I think there's a kind of there's a form of debating that it's named after as well, but Socratic, I think that might be one way of putting it.
Yeah.
What's the advantage for you of that?
Well, let's take language learning for a minute as an example. So when a person learns a language in a classroom, they might learn certain stock phrases and verbal forms, but then they get thrown out into another country where everybody speaks that language, and they don't know the colloquialisms. They quickly get lost in the conversation because they've never had real conversation. And I think it's sometimes the same when it comes to a philosophy of religion and apologetics, that you have a monograph, you have a treatise that presents a particular argument, but it's not shared within the warp and woof of daily life and real conversation. So what we wanted to do was throw people in to learn the language on the streets of that foreign country, to be immersed into a real life debate dialogue, much as it might unfold in a bar. And I will say, by the way, that some of my Baptist brethren and sisters would prefer it was two people walking into a coffee shop, but we'll just leave that for another day.
Yes. We don't have such a problem in the church with the idea of Christians going into a pub here in the UK. But in any case, I think it really works. It genuinely. And I think much better as well, in the sense that you're both really a Christian and both really an atheist, than some of those invented dialogues that sometimes people try, which are really just setting up a straw man to knock over and so on. But thank you very much anyway. Again, if you're interested in reading it for yourself, An Atheist and a Christian Walk into a Bar, Talking About God, the Universe and Everything, published by Prometheus. You might want to check out the link at Randall Rouser's website, randallrouser.com. You can find it on Amazon, and just type it into Google. You'll find it one way or another. So that's worth doing. If you like the format of Unbelievable, I think you'll love the format of this book. But we're going to be talking in the remainder of today's program about one of the issues that you unpack in the conversation in the book, specifically religious disagreement. This idea that, well, if there is a God, shouldn't that God have every motive to cause people to believe predominantly the same things about himself? And that clearly isn't the case in the world we live in. So we're going to be talking about that. If you'd like to respond to either this book or indeed the conversation we're having on the program today, do get in touch. I'd be interested to hear from you. As usual, you can email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can find us online at the website premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Loads of back catalogue of episodes, ways to engage with the show, links to the social media as well. If you want to follow me on Twitter @unbelievablejb and facebook.com/unbelievablejb to like the Facebook page of the show. We're talking about The Atheist and the Christian Who Walked into a Bar.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
So coming back to you both, Randall and Justin, my guests on the show today, what I like about this is it gives it a dialogue, but you also get a lot of content packed in there as well, because you've obviously marshalled your arguments and material well. And so you get these different segments, you know, you have a debate on a particular subject and see it through. One of the meaty things you debate is religious disagreement. And this is really an argument that you're putting forward in the book for atheism and against God, Justin. So do you want to talk about that and maybe even start out with the interesting analogy of the landlord and the two tenants that you use to kind of make your case there?
Yeah, so An analogy that I use in the book to kind of unpack this argument is a kind of tale of two tenants. So I have Tom and Mike. These are two tenants that are renting within the same apartment complex. And so for business reasons, they're told by their landlord that their landlord only communicates privately with each tenant. He'll never communicate in with a group of tenants. And so he tells them each these different things. And while these tenants go about their daily lives, they enter communications and they in their communications, they discover some pretty big incompatibilities about their beliefs of the land about the landlord. So for example, you know, of Tom and Mike, our two tenants, Tom says that the landlord wants all residents to pay rent by check. And yet Mike insists that the landlord commands that all residents pay in cash. Tom says that the landlord is a woman. Mike insists that the landlord is a man. Tom claims that the landlord assures him that all residents pay $1,000 a month for rent, while Mike says that the landlord insists that all residents only pay $600 a month. So as one would expect, these kinds of disagreements, admittedly some being trivial, but some still being substantive, they would understandably introduce a kind of tension, both between Tom and Mike, between the tenants, and between Tom and the landlord and Mike and the landlord. So in all the different ways that relationships can be affected, this is a pervasive issue. These kind of disagreements introduce tension that wouldn't otherwise be there. And this tension it runs in the face of the goals of the landlord, right? The goal of the landlord, presumably, is to have an efficient business, to run a business where the tenants are happy, where everyone kind of gets along and everyone's very clear on what the expectations are of all parties involved. And yet that's not what we seem to find. We find that, you know, the revelations of the landlord to his tenants seem to be incompatible. And so obviously the analogy here is that you have many different people who believe in God. And so what's interesting here is that my argument limits the scope of the argument to discussing just those persons who are devout believers in God, so who have a kind of a positive attitude toward the idea of God. They believe in God, and they all believe that they have received in some sense or another different forms of revelation, be they text or personal experience. And yet much of the content here is logically incompatible. And so I'm arguing that that kind of disagreement introduces tension between believers and between believers and their God. That this, you know, if someone realizes that a lot of different people believe different things about God, they might be confused about their own relationship with God. Maybe they don't have the proper relationship with God. And the kinds of disagreements I'm interested in are not like trivial disagreements, because presumably there's some value in allowing people to fix their disagreements among themselves, right? The kind of disagreement I'm interested in is the kind of disagreement that's very fundamental. So we're talking about how best to enter and maintain a relationship with God. What's true about history? Is there a salvific narrative that's relevant here? All these really core questions about that really pop into view in theistic religion are at issue here.
So you've very well laid out then the issue, and the analogy really helps as well, of the landlord and the two tenants who get differing views about exactly who this landlord is and what his requirements are. Let's put this out then to Randall. What do you make of that, Randall, and what's your overall response to this issue over religious disagreement?
Great. So let's begin then with the illustration of the landlord. I think often it's important to always pause and ask precisely how is an analogy supposed to be functioning. For this analogy to carry through, presumably it follows that just as the landlord is specifically revealing different information to two different tenants, so Justin's claim is that God is specifically revealing different information to different people. He's revealing one thing, let's say, to Christians, and another thing to Muslims, and another thing to Jews or some other theistic community. Of course, at that very point right there, Christian is not necessarily, or other theists need not necessarily accept that that is the case. They could believe that God has revealed certain information about himself to one group that he has not done to another group. So that part of the analogy wouldn't carry. Now, Justin, of course, or this brings me to the second point. Justin would probably ask, well, why would he do that? And he already conceded, if you listen to him at the end, that there are conditions under which God could presumably have morally sufficient conditions, reasons, to reveal certain information about himself to one group or to one individual, which he does not to another, from which some level of disagreement ensues. I think the burden of proof is then on him to say why the degree of disagreement that we do find in the world today is an unacceptable degree. I mean, this comes back to a problem with objections to God's existence based on evil. If the objector wants to argue that God does not have morally sufficient reasons to allow the amount and distribution and intensity of evil we find in the world today, then the objector has to explain how much evil God would allow and how much evil he would not have a morally sufficient reason to allow. And I think it's the same problem here. If Justin wants a sustainable objection to God's existence based upon religious disagreement, he has to explain why the degree of disagreement we do in fact find in the world today is a reason to believe that God doesn't exist, because allegedly God could not have a reason to allow that.
If I could interject before we come back to Justin there, I mean, it would be helpful to give some examples of how, you know, it might be possible to see that God does have some reasons for allowing religious disagreement to take place in the world. So do you have any kind of ways of which you could suggest this might be one reason why God actually wouldn't necessarily be an overall bad thing to allow people to disagree about God?
So I think that broadly speaking, you can kind of put potential disagreements into two different categories. One of the categories being relatively trivial disagreements, and one of the categories being disagreements that are such that they are so important and fundamental to relationship with to key relational and moral issues. So, for example, you know, a parent and a child relationship, right? Like, let's say a parent has two twin toddlers, right? And the toddlers are disagreeing about who gets to play the video game next, right? The toddlers, you know, they'll have to come up with some kind of social contract to kind of navigate that disagreement about, you know, what's fair, you know, among the two individuals. And the parent isn't, you know, the parent is going to find value in that kind of exchange. And so that parent won't necessarily feel obligated to kind of enter in the exchange. And, you know, unless someone's being bullied or something, the parent's not going to have much of a reason to, you know, lay out a strict timeline of who can play what video game and when. But nevertheless, in the broad theistic situation, these disagreements do not amount to mere disagreements about video game time. These are disagreements about the very nature of God himself, about how to become saved. Are we saved by, you know, do we earn our salvation, or is our salvation given merely by grace? What religious tradition is true? What is true about history? What profound moral truths are true? Should we organize a government around a democracy, or do we need to establish a caliphate? These are fundamental disagreements where you can find devout theistic believers on all sides of these disagreements. And just to clarify a quick point of the argument, my argument is not saying that God, that really any theistic believer would advocate that God is giving incompatible revelation. I'm not making that claim. What I'm saying is that the disagreements that do pop up, everyone claims they're from God, but clearly that can't be true. Or, I mean, if it is true, then you have to explain why God would be giving incompatible revelations. But the point is that God has reasons to correct those misunderstandings, to identify which is true and which is false, and to clarify that, because only then will you be able to kind of get people to understand how best to interact with God, how best to enter a relationship with God.
Well, swinging it back to you then, Randall, at this point, I mean, I guess what I wanted to get as well, just before we go to a break, is some clarification about what kind of reasons you would give for why religious disagreement might be good. So Justin gave there the idea that, OK, well, you know, like a parent letting toddlers sort it out between themselves, there may be some value in that, I guess it produces some kind of character that we want to see develop in people. Are those the kind of reasons you might give for why God would allow a certain amount of religious disagreement in the world?
Certainly that would be part of it. I give an illustration in the book of a team building exercise where a group of people in, say, from a company or on one of those weekends of development, personal development, and they're given a task and they have to figure out how to accomplish this task. And that challenge gives them an opportunity. There's going to be some disagreement, some tension in interpreting the instructions and so on, but that is all part of building virtues and character within the group and the individuals that constitute the group. I would also say that one of the big issues here is a philosophy of pedagogy. So how do you teach people something? And I think one of the facts we have to keep in mind that any good teacher knows is that you gradually bring people to a greater understanding of a particular truth. So in one grammar class, you may teach the students I before E, except after C. And the other class is a little more advanced, so they've also learned or when sounding like A as in neighbor and way. And technically, those are incompatible principles because the one seems to limit the grammatical principle to I before E except after C, and the other expands it. But the grammar teacher knows that that is a proper way to bring students into a larger understanding. So I think some of the disagreement we find is also explicable in terms of God as a master pedagogue or master teacher, accommodating himself to various students and revealing different aspects of his nature and moral requirements to them at different times.
We're going to take a quick break because I don't want anyone to start talking and me have to cut them off. But I would like to come back to you, Randall, to also this issue that Justin raises about, but aren't there all kinds of disagreements that are so fundamental that really God has every reason and should really intervene to make sure people aren't believing things that would, you know, potentially limit their salvation or whatever. We'll come back to you for that in a moment's time. On the program today, this is Unbelievable, a show that brings Christians and non-Christians together. I'm talking to Randall Rouser. He's a Christian theologian, and Justin Schieber. He's an atheist philosopher. They've both contributed to the program before. They've just written a book together. It's really good. You should read it. An Atheist and a Christian Walk into a Bar, talking about God, the universe and everything. And we're just digging into one of the areas that they explore in that dialogue in the book today, religious disagreement. Come back in a short moment's time.
Premier Christianity, for cutting edge commentary and encouraging stories.
Tackling the big issues to help you live out your faith.
Have you heard the one about the three comedians who walked into a church? In our New Year edition, meet Milton Jones, Sally Phillips and Paul Carenza as they have a conversation on putting together their faith with careers in TV and radio comedy. Plus, we talk to the Reverend Richard Coles, former 80s pop star, now one of the UK's most famous vicars. Sam Hales attends a New Age fair and tells you what happened. All that plus much more.
For your free copy of Premier Christianity, visit premierchristianity.com/freesample.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to today's programme. Hope you're enjoying it. And we're going to be bringing you more things that you might enjoy later on Premier Christian Radio. Between 4 and 5, The Profile, as we sit down with another leading Christian to talk about their journey of faith. Don't forget that you can find out more about Unbelievable at our website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Find links to the podcast. Lots of people download the show every week. Videos, resources, articles, last year's Unbelievable conference on DVD. And don't forget that we're going to be releasing details soon, hopefully by the end of this month, about the forthcoming Unbelievable conference. We're looking forward to seeing people on Saturday the 13th of May. That's the date to put in your diary if you can get to London for this year's conference. A bit earlier in the year than we've done it the last couple of times. So we'd love to see you there if you can make it. Don't forget, you can also email in as well. We'll be hearing some of your thoughts towards the end of today's show about some of the recent programmes we've aired over the New Year and Christmas break. Today we're talking about the atheist and the Christian who walked into a bar. Well, they certainly have had some discussions in a bar or two. But this book was written really as the fruit of many discussions they'd had together. Justin Sheba and Randall Rouser talking about their different perspectives as a Christian and an atheist. And in their new book, An Atheist and a Christian Walk Into a Bar, they tackle all kinds of issues, God, the universe and everything. Today, we've been talking about religious disagreement. Is the fact that so many conceptions of God, different religions in the world exist, evidence against God? His view, Justin's view is yes, it is. Randall's view is no, not necessarily. We're getting into that, a very interesting discussion about that. So, Randall, I'm going to come back to you because your view, as we heard, is that A, there may be some reason why God would allow a certain amount of disagreement for some kind of character building purpose and so on. And it's really Justin has to show why it reaches such a level that therefore it counts against God before we can dismiss the existence of God. But Justin's overall point is it feels like some of these issues are so important, so fundamental. You know, forget about the character building stuff, Randall. This could determine someone's eternal future. So what do you say to that kind of stuff?
Yeah, I like how you set that up. So let me say a couple things. First, I just want to quickly reiterate, it's not simply that this is some possible way. I think that we really do see manifest goods in this. I was in an ecumenical dialogue a few months ago with Lutherans, Baptists, and Catholics. And the fact that we all came together and had to learn to dialogue and listen to one another was a profound experience. And I think we shouldn't underestimate the value of that. A second point I would make is the value of freedom. Now, Pascal famously made this point when we talk about God's hiddenness, that God is allowing us the freedom to find him through rational reflection. He doesn't force himself upon us. And so I think there's value in that. Third point I would just say quickly, I'll go to Romans 2, 14 and 15. Paul says, "For when Gentiles who do not have the law by nature do what the law requires, they are a law to themselves, even though they do not have the law. They show that the work of the law is written on their hearts." Now, I think that's an important point that any theist can keep in mind. Justin's objection seems to be that people shouldn't be held morally culpable or responsible for failing to act on knowledge they have not been given. And I agree. I don't think that Christianity, let alone bare theism, commits us to such a proposition. I think that God judges each person appropriately based upon the degree of revelation to which they have access.
That's an interesting response. And I guess it does get us into that whole area of, you know, what about people who have never heard of Jesus and all the rest of it? But why for you isn't that enough of a response, Justin, to kind of mitigate God's responsibility when it comes to this religious disagreement?
Sure. I think, so Randall brought up a kind of team building analogy to kind of tease out some of the benefits that we might that might be available on allowing some kinds of disagreement to persist. So what's interesting, though, is that in team building exercises, people are drawn together to combine their strengths as individuals to kind of figure out the best solution to whatever problem or task given by an instructor, right? But imagine if prior to the group coming together, the instructor met privately with each individual of the group and gave them fundamentally different problems to solve, rules to obey, and time limits to follow. So then ask yourself, well, how successful is a team building exercise going to be if everybody has their own fundamentally different view about what they're even supposed to be doing as a team? So in essence, the team building analogy supports my point. What we would expect from a team building exercise is for some clarification to come from the top down about exactly what is expected from the participants. And that's the exact argument that I'm forwarding. We do not have that top-down clarification, and that's a problem for theism, I think. Moreover, when it comes to the argument, I think that what I'm suggesting here is that the denial of theism just makes better sense of this data, and so it's evidence against theism. So theism has a number of reasons why we should be surprised at both the degree and the widespread nature of religious disagreement. So if God exists, he'd want every one of his willing and open creatures that have the truth about God's existence, to understand how best to live, how to live the good life, and all those various fundamental details I laid out before. Moreover, if God is ultimate truth, God values truth for its own nature, and there's an intrinsic reason to prevent, or at least to intervene, to prevent the persistence of false belief. So there's, I think, at least two very fundamental reasons why God would prevent this persistence of false belief about God if he were to exist.
What's your response to that, Randall?
So I'd like to come back to Justin's rebuttal to the team building analogy. As he refashions it, he says, well, the person, the manager overseeing the team building exercise, reveals incompatible information to each person. First point I would say is that the theist, of course, need not accept that claim that God is revealing specific different things to different people. The theist might believe that some religious disagreement is simply the result of people being mistaken or perhaps being in rebellion against God and denying something he has revealed to them. So I would reject that as a refashioning of the analogy. Second point I would say is, as I already said with the grammatical analogy, I before E except after C, the manager could reveal certain things to different people prior to the advent of the team building and exercise with a good reason for doing so. He reveals greater information or somewhat different information to one rather than another because he's accommodating himself to the skills and aptitudes of that individual or group. Third point I would say is, I actually think, contrary to Justin, that there is some substantial agreed upon rules that go across the board. And we already saw them, I think, in Romans 2, 14 and 15, when Paul talks about a law being written on our hearts. This sense of a moral law, a general framework for how we are to live, for a sense of holiness, for a sense of moral obligation, a sense of moral right, I think that does provide a framework that transcends cultures, which Paul himself then says, that's what you are first of all judged on, is how you are responding to that. So I think at that point, especially, that Justin's attempted rebuttal breaks down.
And something I'd add as well, Justin, I have no idea if Randall agrees with this or not, but I've sometimes felt that as much as there is lots of differences of opinion about God in the world, one could point to the fact that belief in God, in the divine, is so widespread, is innate almost across all cultures, that's consistent with the idea that there may be a God. Obviously someone may come up with some evolutionary reason why, sure, people have good reasons to, you know, believe in God or whatever, but nonetheless, does it swing both ways slightly, the fact that there is this extraordinary sort of prevalence of belief in God, albeit varied in its local interpretations? Is that any evidence for God?
Yeah, no, I think you bring up an interesting point. One thing I do want to say is that, again, I'm not advocating that God is somehow giving incompatible revelations to different people. That's not the argument. I'm giving these analogies to show how different people might interpret these kinds of situations, right? So in the team building analogy, I'm setting up a situation where every person in that team believes something fundamentally different about the goals of that particular exercise. That's a problem. You would expect the instructor at that point to clarify the goal of the project. Otherwise, everyone, you can't work together on a goal. You can't work together unless you know what the goal is, right? That's the point of the team building analogy, typically.
I mean, what I took from and Randall, you may want to clarify here, Randall's response, though, was that he thinks the fundamental goal isn't so unclear, that all people are on some kind of, you know, quest to discover God and to have meaning in life and to find salvation in that sense. But then they obviously come up with very different ways in which they think that should be done. But so I suppose it depends what you think the goal is and why you would think it seems to be so mismatched between different religions in that sense, Justin. But Randall, do you want to just clarify what you think this fundamental goal is, that, you know, and you've already spoken about Romans and what you think Paul's getting at there?
Yeah, so I can maybe just highlight a little bit more. I think that, so what we're supposed to be debating here is mere theism at this point. Does the religious disagreement in the world provide evidence against such a being as God, where God is this maximally perfect, powerful, omnipotent, wise being? And I think what's going on with Justin's objection is that he's adding something to that, which is some form of exclusivism. Namely, if you do not have certain doctrinal beliefs about God sorted in this life, then that's going to have egregious eternal consequences. And a theist simply need not accept that. A theist could accept, for example, as I've suggested here, some sort of inclusivism, which says that God judges people on the evidence that they've been given. He judges them on their heart. And that's consistent with all sorts of people finding themselves in a reconciled relationship with God, despite lacking particular dogmatic or doctrinal beliefs about God. So I don't think that his argument functions unless you assume a much narrower exclusivism to go along with your theism.
Okay. How would you respond to that, Justin?
Yeah, I don't think that my argument entails any exclusivism whatsoever. So I think that what it boils down to is that there are many people who believe that they have a genuine revelation from God, but that these revelations are incompatible. And not only, this is important, not only does that introduce tension between persons and God as a potential barrier for a deeper relationship with God, but it also introduces tension between different believers who disagree about the fundamental nature of God. So, for example, you're going to have disagreements between different traditions, and, you know, for some people, they might believe that, you know, the best way to be in favor with God is to establish a caliphate and to impose certain bits of violence on individuals. Other people might find that to be a threat, and so that introduces tension, right? But that doesn't mean that these beliefs are not genuine beliefs about the fundamental nature of God. Other people might believe that, you know, if you don't you don't have a personal relationship with specifically Jesus, that you're going to go to hell. And so persons with children who are being raised in a Christian home might have a reason to prevent their children from interacting with children of other faiths or traditions, because, you know, that puts them at least at risk. So there are all these kinds of tensions that it introduces between the people on the ground. Moreover, this isn't about exclusivism as so much as it is God caring about truth. Not all of these people can be correct about God. Some people are going there, you know, if there is someone that's correct, then there's going to be at least many people that are wrong about this. And it seems to me like a God who is absolute truth would care to correct false beliefs.
Is it God's job to make sure people believe the right things then, Randall?
Well, that's a complicated question. I think that when Justin talks about truth, we have to and we can add to that knowledge, we have to distinguish between different kinds of knowledge. So there is the knowledge of propositional truth. There is also a knowledge of acquaintance or a knowledge of experience. And Justin focuses exclusively, it seems to me, on this issue of doctrinal disagreement or knowledge of propositional truth. And I think that's a very reductionistic way to think about it, because if you think about a parent-child relationship, the profundity of that relationship begins far before that child ever learns any propositional truth about their parent. When they are developing fetus, when they are a newborn in their mother's arms, when they are a toddler, they are slowly beginning to acquire propositional truth, but all the time they have an acquaintance knowledge of their parent. So I think if Justin wants a sustainable argument here, he also needs to consider the value of acquaintance knowledge and of a developmental acquaintance knowledge, just as you have with a parent and child. How does he know that there is not a vast amount of acquaintance knowledge that is gradually being acquired by individuals and communities through time, which does not greatly ameliorate the strength of his objection as he presently perceives it?
Go ahead, Justin.
Sure. So I think that at the end of the day, relationships are going to be two-way streets, and those streets are at their best when they're paved with a mutual awareness. So when it comes to disagreements here, when it comes to the value of relationships, I think it's quite clear that the most meaningful relationships are those which are entered into freely by willing and aware participants. It might be the case that there is some substantive kind of relationship that exists between precognitive fetuses or something and their mothers. This is something that Randall and I discuss in the book about the, you know, different kinds of relationships that might exist. But I think that why would God settle for the most trivial kind of relationship, being that where one of the participants has no clue that they're even in a relationship, and a relationship where someone freely enters into a relationship with the divine? That seems to me the kind of cat's pajamas of divine human relations. So it doesn't make sense to me why, if the option's there, why we would settle for a relationship that's based on false understandings of God, but nevertheless they somehow get this vague idea of a moral essence. That just seems rather empty when compared to a more deeper relationship.
If I could quote you from the book here, Justin, as well.
Sure.
You say to Randall, your proposal amounts to little more than an imaginative and ad hoc what-if scenario. So your overall point, and maybe this is the one to toss back here to Randall as well, is, okay, Randall, you can come up with lots of maybes about these situations, but to me, it looks like the more obvious explanation is there isn't a God there. People are just coming up with their different ideas, as humans do, about God. That, you know, you can come up with some kind of way of, you know, making it feel sound a little bit better for God, but overall, on a common sense view, it looks more atheistic than theistic. I'm getting that sense from you.
Yeah, when it comes to the general outline of the argument, it's inductive. It's, well, probably better posed as an abductive argument, as an argument to the best explanation. I mean, presumably, if the world were different, let's say if people on different continents all somehow came to not only belief in God, but specific agreement on doctrinal beliefs, having not even communicated with each other, presumably if that's the world we lived in, Randall would be on the other side of the microphone arguing that this is evidence for God. That fact should lead us to think that the disagreement that we have in our actual world is evidence against God.
So there's a few things there to pick up on, Randall. Where do you want to begin?
I have to come back for a minute to what Justin said about acquaintance knowledge and then go from there. So he mentioned, I had given the illustration of an infant and the infant's mother. The infant lacks any propositional knowledge but has a profound acquaintance knowledge of the mother. Justin referred to that relationship, and these were his words, the most trivial kind of relationship, he says, is a non-cognitive relationship of one person to another. And I just emphatically disagree with that. I don't think that he's begun to appreciate the value of acquaintance knowledge. That mother has a profound acquaintance, a mutually bonded relationship with her child. Compare that to the relationship with her coworker in the next cubicle in the office. That coworker may have all sorts of propositional knowledge about the mother, but has no profound relationship with her. By contrast, the infant who lacks that cognitive propositional knowledge nonetheless has a profound relationship. And until we value that kind of relationship, I don't think we're going to properly be able to assess the issue at hand. Second point I'd like to say is, as to which seems more plausible, I would just point to our conversation right now. I think that there is enormous value in a person like Justin and myself dialoguing about these issues, debating these issues, and doing so ironically friendly, developing our own relationship as we try to understand better who God is or if God is. So I think the very fact that we are having this conversation, the very fact that we wrote this book, provides more evidence for the plausibility of my rebuttal to Justin's objection.
But Justin says, hey, if it turned out everyone had just the same beliefs across the world on different continents about God, wouldn't you equally be making a case for God from that?
Well, the thing is, I'm not making a case for God either way. What I'm doing is showing that whether everybody agreed about God or whether we don't, neither one of those is an objection to God. I'm not saying that we should reason to God's existence based upon that data. I'm simply saying that data is not a good reason to reject God's existence.
Okay. There are so many Justins in this program, I sometimes get confused. But Justin the atheist, what's your response to that?
Yeah, so when it comes to the different values of different levels of relationship, I just fundamentally disagree with Randall here. I think that when a relationship involves two persons that are both aware that they're in a relationship, that's fundamentally more valuable than a relationship that involves two persons where one of them really adores the other. and the other one barely is even aware that they exist. Okay, that seems to me like an obvious example of a huge difference in value between two different kinds of relationships. Moreover, when it comes to the kind of evidential point I was making, what I was saying is that if we were to learn, if we were in a different world wherein people on different continents believe not only in theism, right? Because we could, there's decent evolutionary explanations for why many humans would be susceptible to kind of belief in supernatural persons, right? That's not to say that these beliefs are false. That's just a fact about evolutionary history, that there are processes that make our brains favorable to those kinds of beliefs. And in fact, that's what we see. A lot of people believe in theism. But what if it were the case that we didn't only believe in theism, we also arrived at specific doctrinal beliefs? What I'm posing is that if in such a world, Randall would be using that as an argument for theism, regardless of what objections there might be for theism, that would be an argument for theism. Because how on earth would an atheistic worldview explain such specificity and agreement on theological concepts? That would be crazy to try to explain on an atheistic worldview. And Randall would have a ready explanation, personal revelation. And that's quite clearly going to be strong evidence favoring theism. It just happens to be that that's not the world we live in.
We're kind of discussing two different points here at the moment, and so I'll let you respond to both of them, Randall, again. But just to summarize, one of these points is Justin saying he doesn't see how the relationship of a mother to an infant who perhaps has no real awareness of the mother at this point in their development counts as the same kind of importance of a relationship as the one who is consciously aware of the other. I mean, just to catch me up as much as anything, is the analogy in the God situation, okay, there are some people who claim to have, you know, a direct relationship with God and awareness of God. There are other people who haven't given it the least bit of thought. They're very happy atheists, never thinking about God. But nevertheless, it's still important to God that he has a relationship, even though it's in no way reciprocated towards him. Have I got the right idea there? Is that kind of what you're saying, Randall?
Well, so it could apply in all sorts of different ways, because whether lacking proposition, the point is simply lacking propositional knowledge. So whether it's knowledge of existence or it's some other degree of knowledge, I certainly don't think we're in a place as bare minimal theists to say what God's relationship is with people who don't believe in God's existence. And I think that there are all sorts of reasons why people don't believe in God's existence. So Christians should be pretty quick, should be slow to judge individuals. For example, if you have Asperger's syndrome, there's a much higher likelihood that you won't believe in God's existence. And that seems to be in part due to your cognitive wiring, that there's an inability to conceive of an abstract, non-physical being, let alone to conceive yourself relating to that being. I think Christians need to be careful about making any rash judgments about how someone with Asperger's or some other place on the spectrum of autism does or does not relate to God. I think what we have to appreciate at the bare minimum is that there is great value in acquaintance knowledge. And what Justin has said, I think simply is failing to appreciate the incredible value of that kind of non-propositional acquaintance knowledge. Now, I want to come to then address his second point when it comes to Justin says, even though I already said I wouldn't use that model he proposed for an argument for God's existence, he said I would, that if it was the case that people naturally develop these beliefs about God, then I would use that as evidence for God's existence. I simply disagree. I wouldn't do that.
I've got some sympathy for Justin here, though, because you would use maybe a fine-tuning of the universe argument, an argument essentially from design, maybe, as evidence for God. I find it almost inconceivable that if we all around the world independently came up with the same idea of God, we wouldn't say, oh, that needs an explanation. That's obviously designed. That's something that is good evidence for God. So are you saying you wouldn't use that argument, Randall?
I'd say I'd be pretty careful about that. And I'll give you one reason why. And that's because for those of us who accept neo-Darwinian evolution, There are multiple cases where body types emerge through selective pressures that appear to be undirected, that we don't need to posit an intelligence. So, for example, you get marsupials and mammals on different continents evolving, emerging, that have very similar body structures. You have eyes that emerge at least 50 times in evolutionary
independently,
history,
yeah.
independently evolve. Mm. If you can have that with body types, I think, how do you know that selective pressures likewise over time wouldn't lead to people developing a theological broad agreement, if not unanimity? So in my view, I think that if you're simply looking at whether there's agreement or disagreement, that really underdetermines the question of theism versus atheism. So I'd be pretty reluctant about making an argument for or against God's existence based on that evidence.
Wow. Okay, we're going to come back with Justin in a moment's time, listening to a fantastic discussion, dialogue, not really a debate. Debate makes it sound like people kind of, you know, have it in for each other. And my guests don't today, because they've written a very friendly book, An Atheist and a Christian Walk into a Bar. And we're kind of hearing them discuss one of the specific aspects of that today, religious disagreement. Randall Rouser and Justin Sheba are my guests here on Unbelievable, the programme that brings Christians and non-Christians together for dialogue and debate. Come back again in a short moment's time for the final part of this week's show.
In July 2016, Unbelievable, the conference took place in London, a day for any Christian who struggles to share their faith with others.
I'm Justin Brierley, and I hosted a fantastic day of inspirational sessions with J. John, Gary Habermas, Beth Grove, and many others.
Now you've got the chance to watch and listen to over 12 hours of this empowering conference,
featuring evangelism, apologetics, and the resurrection.
Get your DVD at premier.org.uk/shop and become a confident evangelist today.
Welcome back to the final part of today's show, and we'll be concluding our conversation here on Unbelievable between my guests Justin Sheba and Randall Rouser. Can I mention that if you're sticking around after Unbelievable, between 4 and 5 on the profile, I'll be speaking to Paul Weston. Now, Paul is a church leader in Sidcup, and he's also a speaker at Spring Harvest each year. He's on the planning team for that event. I'm a speaker there quite often as well, year on year. But Paul's got the most amazing story of being an orphan, how that affected him growing up, and how he came to believe in God. You'll want to hear his testimony. It involves the miraculous. It is one of the most extraordinary stories I've heard, actually, about as a youth, him coming to Christ through a set of extraordinary circumstances and seeing a lot of his friends as well become Christians. Listen to that between 4 and 5 this afternoon. His story also told in the latest edition of Premier Christianity magazine, the January edition, out now. If you want a free sample copy, go to the website premierchristianity.com. Well, towards the end of today's show, we're going to be hearing some of your feedback. I've got loads that has built up over the Christmas and New Year period. So we'll be looking at some of the things you had to say about recent episodes of the show. Right now, time to get into the final part of today's discussion.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Well, concluding our discussion today, we've been talking about the atheist and a Christian who have been having a lovely dialogue, and I think really put both their positions across very well. They've had a chance to do it before, of course, in the book they've written together, An Atheist and a Christian Walk into a Bar, talking about God, the universe and everything. It's published by Prometheus. The authors are Randall Rouser and Justin Sheba. And more than anything, it just demonstrates how people can have a good conversation without falling out with each other, which I think is worth as much as the actual content itself in many ways. We've talked about how the book came into being, and we've gone around the houses quite a bit on this issue of whether the vast array of different religious beliefs in the world is evidence that there is a God behind it. Justin, do you want to start to wrap things up as we head towards the end of today's show?
Sure. So, you know, earlier I made the point that, you know, if it were the case that everyone from across continents, from different populations, believed in specific doctrinal agreements, that, you know, theists would be using this as evidence for God. And Randall replied to that saying, we got to be careful about that, because evolution could have, you know, through convergent evolution, could have brought about these kinds of beliefs. I find that remarkably implausible. So, you know, there certainly are several kinds of plausible evolutionary benefits and therefore explanations for widespread beliefs in a general category of immaterial persons or spirits, right? But anybody familiar with that literature is well aware that the specificity ends starkly there. More nuanced, content-rich doctrines that serve to divide up the great monotheistic beliefs that I'm appealing to today simply are not going to be plausibly sensitive to these kinds of selective pressures. I mean, ask yourself, what kinds of evolutionary selective pressures would bring humanity toward a unified belief in, say, a triune God, or in divine simplicity, or in a particular understanding of the doctrine of atonement? These are just not plausible ideas here. And so because doctrinal agreement would be evidence for God, doctrinal disagreement to the widespread degree that we have it in the actual world is quite clearly evidence against God.
Randall, do you want to reply, and then we'll start to begin to bring things together?
Sure. So Justin says that he just doesn't find this plausible, that you'd have these natural convergent forces that might bring about some degree of doctrinal agreement. I find that really ironic, because beginning in the middle of the 19th century, when Feuerbach proposed a projection theory of religion, and then Freud and Marx and others developed it, it's been very common among atheists to say that religious beliefs and belief in a fatherly figure who has this maximal power, which you do find, Justin, as you noted, Justin Brierley, that is, you do find that across cultures. There have been all these naturalistic accounts of how evolutionary pressures would bring about religious belief and agreement. So the fact that Justin finds that implausible, just I find that really striking, because I think that there is broad agreement among many atheists and skeptics that you can explain this degree of agreement that you do find through evolutionary processes. And so what he'd have to say is, but it's just implausible to say that there could be any more than what we find. Now, the second point I just make to wrap up is, even if agreement did support God, like a higher degree of agreement did support the existence of God, it wouldn't follow that the current relative lack of agreement doesn't support God. So, I mean, even if I did take that view, it doesn't follow that the state of affairs we are currently in supports atheism.
Okay. I mean, Justin, I guess there are lots of arguments both for and against God out there. I've always kind of felt like this one is another version of the problem of evil, because essentially it's saying if there is a God, then he should, he's obliged to make people believe in him properly so that they do come in, you know, into relationship with him and so on. And it's therefore unjust for him not to do that in some way. But I mean, in that sense, there may be other arguments that Randall has up his sleeve to do with, I don't know, cosmology, morality, all those other things, which he says, even if there's some strength to your argument here, Justin, it's not decisive. There's plenty of other, you know, evidence on the other side of the scale, which goes against that. I mean, how strong an argument, I suppose I'm asking, is this against God? Is this like a killer blow for you? Or is it just this should make the theist ponder whether they're really right about this?
Sure. I think that this is but one argument among many. It needs to be weighed, and I think it has significant weight to it. Nevertheless, there's nothing preventing an individual like Randall or any other theist from having a bunch of other arguments on the other side and saying, well, the cumulative strength of these arguments outweighs your disagreement argument and the argument from evil or any other atheistic argument, and therefore I still find theism to be more plausible. There's nothing that omits that. This is certainly not a deductive argument that completely makes God irrational to believe, right? And you know, that said, I think it is a strong argument, and because of that, I think it deserves consideration. And so I think that Randall and I have a really substantive dialogue in the book because of the power of the argument. I think that he recognizes that it needs to be taken seriously.
And you've obviously dealt with it in quite a philosophically rigorous way. But I think in general terms, people kind of make this argument all the time. You know, friends of mine who say, oh, look at all the different things people believe in Christianity. Oh, how can anyone believe that, you know, they've got the right idea? I think it's generally people kind of intuitively think it shouldn't be this way if there's a God about. Is that
It's funny, because I get the argument, or when I would hear people make those claims, I was initially quite dismissive of them because I've never seen much of a rigorous argument from that. But the more I thought about it, the more I realized that there actually was a substantive philosophical argument there.
And Randall, the thing that this has been making me think about all the time is the words of Jesus as recorded in the Gospel of John, you know, before he goes to his crucifixion. His final prayer for his disciples is that they would be, you know, made one in unity. And that's obviously something we haven't seen in the Christian church over millennia. And so I guess as a Christian, how do you deal with that? The fact that there is so much, not just religious disagreement, but within Christianity, there's been a millennia of disagreement as well.
Yeah, that is something. Like, I don't want it to be seen that I'm brushing away Justin's argument by any means. I'm not persuaded by it, but this is something we have to take seriously. And there is a lot of disagreement within Christianity itself, as you've noted. So the rite of initiation, what does it mean to become a part of the Christian community? Well, there isn't agreement on that. Some people believe in pedobaptism. Some people believe in believer's baptism. What is the central unifying sacrament of Christianity, or ordinance, as I would say as a Baptist? Again, there's some agreement there, but there's also a lot of disagreement. The question is, can we know that God couldn't have morally sufficient reasons for allowing that degree of disagreement? And I'm simply not persuaded that that's the case. I think often when you come to an issue, let's say Calvinism and Arminianism, I'm pretty persuaded that there are providential reasons why God has left that ambiguous. And part of that is us fleshing that out and debating it in hopefully in a charitable and ironic way, much like that team building exercise. So I'm just not persuaded that for myself that it's a sustainable argument, but I can certainly understand why people would find some compelling dimension or plausibility to Justin's argument.
And generally, when it comes to inter-Christian understanding, I'm persuaded that things have improved, for me at least, significantly in the last 50 years. I mean, just here in the UK, the kinds of things that might have divided Catholics and Protestants 50 years ago, it's a completely different world we're living in now in terms of the level of shared fellowship and being able to see each other as brothers and sisters in Christ that now exists.
I share that. I mean, as I briefly said, with this ecumenical dialogue I was a part of a few months ago between Baptists, Lutherans, actually there are also Mennonites, and then Catholics, I just find enormous richness in being challenged to dialogue and listen to one another, understand where one's coming from, another person's coming from. So I do see, I'm persuaded that there is great relational value that God is actualizing through the degree of disagreement that we presently find.
It's been a fascinating discussion. Thank you both for being with me, Justin and Randall, on the show today.
Well, thanks so much for having me again.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun.
And if you want to get...
We can agree on that.
we certainly can, yes. And I can also agree that it is worth people picking up your book, gentlemen. So again, I'll just give a final mention for that. An Atheist and a Christian Walk into a Bar, Prometheus Publishing. Go to the websites. You can find it at randallrouser.com. Find out more about Randall there. Realatheology.com is where you can find out more about Justin. That'll direct you to his YouTube channel, or simply search it up on Amazon. I hope people enjoy reading it as much as I have. But for the moment, thank you both for being on the show today.
Thank you.
Take care.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, I hope you enjoyed today's programme. If you want to get in touch, you can do that via the email address unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can find us online and interact via the social media. Follow me on Twitter @UnbelievableJB, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB for the Facebook page. I post lots of regular updates as well, from articles that I'm interested in to stuff that's going on with the show. So you may want to follow along on social media. All of those links and more available from the programme webpage, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. As I say, looking forward to releasing details soon of Unbelievable, the conference 2017, but I can tell you the date, Saturday the 13th of May. That's the one to put in your diary now and make sure you don't book anything else in, so that you're free to join me in London for another fabulous day of thinking through our faith together.
Okay, let's go to some of your actual emails in regard to recent programmes. We had that fascinating interaction last week between Joe and Tom. Joe the Christian, Tom the atheist, but they go to church together. And just an interesting insight into how that's affected them both. This one from someone who doesn't give their name but says, I'm a Christian, but Mr. Hallam's reasons for not being able to intellectually and morally make sense of Christian doctrine were exceedingly telling. They're exactly what would keep me out of Christianity if I weren't nonetheless convinced that God exists and satisfied that Jesus is his unique divine son and messenger. I don't like first, these are things you agreed with Tom's problems. You say, I don't like the idea of people getting a last minute pass because they believe in Jesus or believe at the last minute. And also the idea of Jesus suffering in their place is even less satisfactory to me. If God isn't going to punish someone's predation, punishing Jesus instead makes it even worse, not better. Well, I could share my opinions on those as well. I've always felt that the whole point about people who maybe make a last minute confession or whatever, well, that is grace, isn't it? It's in the end, it's not fair. Grace is not something that is fair. It's an act of, you know, complete mercy, complete unfairness in that sense. But that is the claim of Christianity that you know, in even though we fully deserved everything we were should have got, Christ took it away from us. And whether that was a decision made, you know, after a life of heinous wrong, but made 2 minutes before you died, or whether you've made that decision at a very early point in your life, it's the same thing. Jesus suffering in their place, don't like that idea. I mean, I've always felt this tension between is God, you know, punishing Jesus in our place is kind of worked out by the simple fact you say, well, it's God on the cross. It's God who is there. It's God who is taking on all of that stuff on our behalf. So it's not as though God puts someone else in place. It's God himself who chooses to be there on the cross. If we believe Jesus is God in the flesh, then surely, for me, I've always felt that kind of resolves the tension. Lots of people obviously feel about that. But this is Fabian, who says, listening to your show about the atheist who's tried Christianity, but neither prayer nor doctrine has shifted his atheism. My friend was a born-again atheist. Interesting phrase, Fabian, who was introduced to deep meditation by Anglican priests, and after 6 months' practice, his atheistic worldview cracked open. As it says in the Psalms, be still and know, I heard from a university lecturer the etymology of the word study and student comes from the word stillness. As it's the 500-year anniversary of Luther, Protestantism has often been accused of being too noisy. I'm not a Catholic myself, though. Thank you, Fabian. Interesting. Maybe that's something Tom could try if he really wants to keep on his pursuit to see if God is true, simply doing something like that. Thank you also to this one from Maria, west of Asheville in North Carolina, emailing. Today's show was invaluable to me. This is still on the Atheist Churchgoer episode. I listened to it while I split house cleaning with my husband. What I gained was the question, what are you trusting God for? And Joe's answer is the right one, I think, and is evidence of his maturity as a Christian. I think we have to grow beyond the long stage of I'm trusting God to answer my needs, to take care of my plights, reduce or eliminate this suffering right now, fix my kids, husband, job, church. But instead to trust God that he will indeed reconcile all things and recreate heaven and earth and descend and be with us who will receive resurrected bodies, and that we will be in his happy presence forever. That is the biblical hope par excellence. Joe clarified that for me, and I was reassured that I too am maturing. On another note about who to invite, have you had Dr. Peter Kraft on? He used to be an evangelical, now a Catholic. Another person to be in dialogue with him is the co-host of the Christian radio news program called The World and Everything in It. His name is Joseph Slife. He had 3 grown sons. One has become a Catholic, so Joseph has as well. Joseph is well-spoken and thoughtful, and he does radio every day. One other thought, Andy Gears, who's a British and who's the creator of the app PrayerMate. Maybe it could be a discussion of the power of prayer and how many obstacles there are to our actually praying. Thank you very much, indeed, Maria, for your suggestions and also for your offer of prayer as well for me and my family.
And let's move on to some of your feedback now to the New Year's Eve show. Jessica Kelly was one of the people who joined me for that. She told her story of losing her four-year-old son, Henry, to brain cancer. And the way she came to terms with that through a theology of warfare when it comes to suffering and sovereignty and so on, that essentially God doesn't preordain or design the circumstances of suffering, but rather it's a factor of the cosmic war going on in the spiritual realm. And for that reason, she didn't have to blame God, but could see that Henry, in that sense, was a casualty of this war. But that every good thing she could give thanks for was from the hand of God. Paul Carpenter on Facebook says, Justin, hope you had a blessed Christmas. I just listened to Unbelievable. It was such a tremendous episode. Jessica Kelly, heartbreaking but enlightening interview. I have had the book for Christmas. And Sarah Foster of Fanda, who spoke so well about apologetics to Islam. I completed their online course earlier this year. It is awesome. Looking forward to reading your book too. Thank you very much, Paul. Yes, Sarah Foster was our other guest on that show, talking about the challenge of educating young Christians about how to respond to Muslim friends and acquaintances who may be challenging them on their Christianity. Darren, responding to the Jessica Kelly part of that show, says, and Darren, as you'll be able to tell, is a pretty forthright atheist, it's pretty clear that your guests are just making up things as they go along based on what makes them feel good. Why do you think that making things up is somehow relevant to the reality of a God and what the God actually looks like? And why do Christians do mental gymnastics and mentally twist themselves all up to not blame God? If any person acted like God, you would find yourself fully justified to blame them. Okay, Darren. And Bex says, I had to write to you to thank you for the most recent episode of Unbelievable. Both Jessica and Sarah encouraged and challenged my faith in very different ways. I lost my first husband to cancer when he was 23, and over the years since have come to a very similar place theologically to Jessica. I hope the church heeds her call to get our perspective on suffering before the crisis comes rather than during the hard times. I found Pete Gregg's book, God on Mute, really helpful in my own wrestling and would have loved to have read Jessica's in the dark days when I wondered if I could trust God again. As for Sarah Foster, thanks for finding her voice and bringing it to our ears. I work for a church in East London where the issues she talks about are very real and plan to be in touch to see if we can work together. Thanks again for the show. Always enjoy Unbelievable. There are sometimes some very special shows which speak to the deep heart as well as to the mind, and this was one of them. Thank you, Bex, for getting in touch. Now, a couple of other Christians, though, while fully seeing the emotion and sincerity of Jessica's story, didn't agree with her theological approach in the end. This is one of them, Wallace in Charleston, says, one question I would have liked to have asked Jessica, especially after she spoke of Jesus's miracles of healing, is whether she believes God had the power to heal her son. Given her theological comments, it seems she would have had to answer no, God didn't have the power because of these other wills and forces in the universe that, at least in my son's case, were stronger than God's. But think about the devastating implications of such an admission for Christian hope. How can I trust that a God who was powerless to heal my child will someday have enough power to raise him from the dead? How could such a God ever accrue enough power to raise all the dead and create a new heaven and new earth? There are other serious implications. If I think God doesn't have power to heal a child, on what basis can I believe that he created the whole cosmos out of nothing? Seems like the logical outgrowth of such a position would be a kind of pantheism or dualism. I can sympathise with how Greg Boyd's theology has appeared comforting to Jessica as she watched little Henry die, but I'm afraid that comfort comes at far too high a price and has implications that are not comforting at all. Better to own the sovereign hand of God and say with Job, though he slay me, yet I will trust in him. That's Wallace. This from Mike in Toronto says, what can one say to a parent who's lost a child? Can you argue theology with someone whose child has suffered and died? Should you not praise the Lord that this parent has not completely lost all hope in a loving God? Would you declare a false dichotomy or quote opposing Bible verses or point out flawed logic? No. So consider, there are those parents who have also lost children and whose children have physical and mental disabilities who find solace in a higher purpose, people whose loved ones suffer in hospital and have chosen not to accept assisted dying, abused and poverty-stricken mothers who have chosen not to abort their children, oppressed people whose entire lives are an endless drudgery but do not choose violence or suicide. They believe that God has a purpose for their lives. No matter the suffering and hardship, God is in control. Even though they cannot understand all the reasons, nothing is beyond God. Like Job, they say, though he slay me, yet will I trust in him. same Bible verse there as Wallace. This is the foundation of their faith. Will you tell them that their God is cruel and uncaring? Will you tell them they are wrong? And Tim in Saskatchewan, I think I'm pronouncing that correctly, Canada, just finished listening to Jessica's story about her view of God regarding her son's death. Such a story is always a tough one for anyone to weigh in on, as most of us can't comprehend what she went through. So I don't want my thoughts to come across as heartless. My wife and I had a miscarriage with our first child and are now waiting hopefully on the arrival of our second in the spring. And even though I never met him, I have a very small understanding regarding the loss of a child. I greatly respect Jessica for being open with her story, but at the same time, I see some big issues with her conclusions. She stated that most Christians start with the assumption that God is sovereign, but through her experience, she's come to understand that God is not fully in control, but works on the side of good. She quotes John 10:10 to defend her position, which says Jesus came to bring life. The issue I have is that Christians don't assume God is sovereign. The Bible states it explicitly. Jesus didn't come to make alive people feel better. He came that dead people may receive life. It's impossible to read John 6 and not think the Bible is clear that God is in full control of everything. Isaiah 46:10 says, "My purpose will be established and I will accomplish all my good pleasure." The fact that Christ was slain before the foundation of the world shows that the immeasurably horrible suffering of the cross was part of God's plan. He didn't do the best he could. He did exactly as he planned. The contention is that our definition of love is so self-centered and shallow, we're unable to appreciate the true love and holiness of God in suffering. Another one of your past guests, Dr. James White, has written a book called Grieving, about when he was a hospital chaplain. He explains how the God who is in control is able to use all circumstances for his purposes because he's ordained them, whereas the impotent God who cannot accomplish all he wills forces us to deal with absolutely pointless suffering. I don't wish to be Johnny Raincloud, but it's so sad to watch so many people reinterpret what the Bible clearly states based from their experiences. I understand it may help us feel better, but when we misrepresent the Bible, we salve our conscience at the cost of God's glory. All right. Thank you, Tim. And for those who are interested, we did do a debate version of that issue when was it 2015 when Kurt Jaros came in with Ken Brownell to debate the warfare versus the kind of Calvinistic view of God and suffering and so on. So you might, if you're interested in looking back in the archives, that's one to look out for. Thanks for all those who've been in touch. Good to get through some of these responses that have come in over the Christmas break. But I hope you can join me again for another edition of Unbelievable. I've got none other than Richard Carrier on the show again at the same time next week. Now, today's show was a very congenial, moderate discussion between two very friendly people. May not be quite the same next week. You're unbelievable. Let me tell you what's coming up. It's going to be a debate between David Marshall, who's a Christian apologist, and Richard Vicart, who is well known as an atheist historian. And they're going to be debating whether Jesus was based on mythical religious figures of his day. David's latest book is on this whole issue. He takes up the case of people like Bart Ehrman, Richard Carrier and others, Reza Aslan, and claims they've made that basically the Gospels were basically an amalgam of various different kinds of religious mythology put together. He's going to be doing that debate with Richard Carrier next week, and I think the sparks are going to fly. So if you'd like to join me for that, then do come along. Hope you can be there as well for the show that gets people talking, Unbelievable. Until then, have a good week.